Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
We're really excited today, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's been about a year since we've been waiting to get this special guest onto our podcast, so it's really good to welcome Damien Mander, who is the founder and CEO of the International Anti-Poachers Foundation.
Yeah.
So welcome, Damien. How exciting.
There's a couple of lasses in this office here might have a bit of a crush on you. I have to say they're very taken back by your vision and your mission. And so they're very grateful to have the opportunity to, and we all are, to have the opportunity to sit and talk to you here.
Yeah.
Well, I won't argue about their taste, but I will apologise for being late today. those of you that are listening, I will commence 5,000 push-ups after this interview. that's what would have happened in the military or something like that. So, yeah, sincere apologies, guys.
No problem. All right, so at Dorothy and the Dealer, we like to start with seeing what our guests are listening to, what your favourite song is of the moment or in at all time. What's your favourite song or what's your go-to song, Damien?
Oh, I've been listening to a lot of old school Rolling Stone stuff at the moment. So either Painted Black or Little Red Rooster. Mid-1960s.
Do you know either of those two songs?
No, I don't know either.
Do you reckon, Damien, you'd be able to sing us a couple of bars?
Give us a bar. Just give us a quick, how does it go?
If you see my little red rooster, please drive him home.
I love it. It's so good to see the different tastes that people have with our podcast and the different songs. Mitch was trying to lead you before into saying Africa from Toto or something, yeah.
I've also been listening to a lot of Mürt, which is it's a new genre. It's German techno marching band.
Really?
M-A-U-T-E. Look it up.
Let me check it out on YouTube. Okay.
Yeah, that'll get the party started.
Oh, now, that's a good place to start this podcast.
Well,
actually,
you've obviously been a bit of a partier. We'll get to that as we go through. One of the things after listening to a couple of your interviews, I loved the fact that, you know, the adversity that happened in your life, you've turned it into something really, really extraordinary. Like, we meet people that do extraordinary things, but what you're doing is so extraordinary and so dangerous, but yet so beautiful and so, like, wow. You know, like, I was really taken back by what it is your mission is and what it takes to do that. And I think for our listeners, I'd like us to get to the sort of person that it takes to be able to do what you've chosen to do with your life, which I just think is so noble. But originally, where do you come from? What happened back there? If I was to walk into your room when you were 10 years old, what were the posters on the wall? You know, what would the books be beside your bed be? Where did it come from? Where did you come from?
10 years old, you would have been Guns N' Roses days. Yeah. And you would have had a mixture of Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield posters on the wall. And, yeah, used to get down to the pub as soon as those posters went up and rip them off the wall. But I was born in Melbourne, actually a place called Mornington. It was about an hour south of Melbourne in Australia. And at a very young age, moved to Sydney about 3 months ago. I did this with my parents, by the way, not crawling myself to Sydney at the age of 3 months, as independent as I do like to be. And Dad ran hotels, so I grew up in hotels. Hey, and you know, we ran some big hotels. And one of them, the Manavale Hotel in Sydney, there, it was one of those highest grossing hotels in the state. And so I grew up around adults. I grew up in an adult environment, and I went to school there, moved back to Melbourne, I think just before I turned 10, and then picked up life back down in Victoria. Yeah. And then, so even being from Melbourne, and that's where most of the family is based these days, I've spent more years in Sydney because that's where I went back to with the military eventually and was based out of there. And living there, so yeah,
right. And then so being raised in hotels, Were your parents publicans? Were they hoteliers?
Or? Yeah, they were. You know, this is back in the days before, you know, a lot of the security companies and that were operating, and you know, sometimes they're a pretty rowdy crowd, and if you want someone kicked out, you had to do it yourself. So, you know, that was I grew up watching mum and dad, you know, have to be able to manage not only the pub, but what can be a pretty wild place, Sydney, back in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then how old were you when you left home?
I would have been 19, hey? Yeah, when I left to join the military. Still remember mum standing there with tears running down her face.
Really?
yeah.
And then, so what, I mean, you know, I've always said our voids or our perceptions of missingness give way to our values, you know, which determines our destiny and who we become. And so what was the pull to go to the military? Because it's a fucking big choice. Like, going to the military at 19 years old, it's like...
Yeah. I remember my dad being so disappointed that I hadn't gone on to university or college, whatever we call it. We all go through, you know, rough patches or just periods of uncertainty. And for me, who was so desperate to figure out who I was at the time, around sort of 17, 18, 19, was even more profound, because it was, and there's a lot of pressure that goes on us these days. You know, at the age of 15, we're going to choose the subjects we're going to do when we're 17 and 18, that decides what we get into university after high school, and decides basically, you know, what we're going to do for the next 10 or 20 years. And it's very fucking hard to ask a 15-year-old what they want to do with the rest of their life. And I almost think we should get our asses kicked out the door and go and, you know, work in a backpackers, or, you know, try a few different trades, travel the world, work behind a bar, and actually grow up a bit, rather than try to figure out what you want to be when you've grown up before you've even come close to it. So I'd started working as just to go back to the diving side, because it'll loop back around to the military, but there's obviously some stuff in the middle there. I think around the age of 13, then I was hanging, you know, we were naughty little shits. You know, always looking for a way to make money or, you know, generate some income so we can buy some weed or some beers or whatever. We used to go to the fishing store and we'd steal fishing lures, in particular the ones used for calamari fishing. And we'd go down to the wharf and we'd sell those to the fishermen. You know, you'd scuff them up a little bit so they didn't look like they're straight out of the packet, like you or some little shit that's just stolen them. And, you know, the reason they're buying these things is because they keep losing them. So I thought, well, maybe we can steal a mask and snorkel and go down and find some of the stuff that's down here. I mentioned the word theft a lot here. It was always not necessarily a fact of not having stuff. It was always just a challenge amongst your mates. And that's, you know, this is the wrong crowd. You know, you don't look back at it now. You know, you're stealing from a small business or something, someone that's trying to make ends meet for their own family. But, you know, these are the little lessons you get along the way. So I started snorkeling, free diving, and collecting fishing lures, and then actually for once earning my own income and being able to sell those back to the fishermen, and then just putting myself through more and more dive courses, getting better gear, getting better equipment, getting up early in the morning and going jumping off in, you know, ice cold waters down off the southeastern tip of Australia there. And it was good money for a kid. And that's what eventually led on, you know, as a kid who's done, just grown up diving, I spent more time in the water than out of it. The ultimate job is to be a Navy diver. And that's eventually where I went when I was.
So were you 19. Young then? You were 19. Sorry, no, when you started diving and getting into the water, were you 15, 16 or?
No, 13. 13.
Right.
Yeah. But I'd grown up in the water. Just never had really got into the diving or snorkeling or spearfishing side of it. Right. And I say spearfishing, it's not something I do now, but it was something that occupied a hell of a lot of time for me growing up. But by the time you sort of get to 18 and, you know, I was out, you know, working a regular job, lost that. Had, by that stage, I had a loan to pay off a car. And so, the only job I could get, I was literally working on a fucking garbage truck. in the Melbourne in a Melbourne summer, chasing a garbage truck around. And I don't want to do that again, hey. It's tough work. It's tough, stinky, smelly work. And yeah. There was an ad that came on the radio one day because I'd already tried to join the Navy as a clearance diver a year earlier, but they weren't taking divers from the street. You had to already be in the Navy before you could transfer category. And then I just heard an advert on the radio one day saying that we're taking electronics technicians in. And so I signed up straight away, went for the interviews. And then I was probably about 7 or 8 months before I went across, to start recruit school. But it was during those 7 or 8 months of okay, truck anymore, but still needing money and wanting to have a good time before I went off to the military. Not that the military didn't turn out to be a bloody good time, but started selling drugs and hanging out with people that, well, actually not hanging out with people. It's just the group of friends that I've grown up with had morphed into that side of things. Not all of them, but a good, enough of them to be led astray. And you know, it was easy. You know, these guys are having a good time. They're partying. They've got their own house. And, money comes in quickly and it goes out quickly. And, that for me looked like an easy way to turn a buck. And I'll never forget it. Hey, it was about a week or so before I went into the Navy, and it was winter. So I think I joined in June, so that's a Melbourne winter. And so it's cold, and I had this like huddled up black Holden HZ Statesman with a 308 engine, like the big muffler. So I come like hooning up the street early in the morning to go and see the lads because they're still all going from the night before. And four of them handcuffed face down on the front lawn. I just sort of froze, and this big dude in a suit just walks over to my car and just leans in on the window. And it's just like, he's like right up like this. And it's like, Mr. Mander, do you want to join your friends or do you want to go to the Navy next week? I said, really? I'd love to go to the Navy next week. Please, sir. And he goes, fuck off. And out of those four friends, two are now dead. And one's just got out of prison recently, hey?
Jesus. Wow. Count your blessings, hey?
Yeah, sometimes all you need is just a stranger to give you a chance for an opportunity. Yeah.
A copper to lean in the window and tell you to fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah. So that was my sort of second chance, I suppose.
So when you got in, you went in for diving, but you didn't stay diving long, did you? Or did you get a chance to do it at all?
Well, I went in and started training as an electronics technician and then put in a request for transfer category.
Yeah.
To clearance diver. They said, no, we don't need more divers. We need more technicians. And so I wrote a letter a day. I think in the end it was about 3 months. A letter a day to the commanding officer, and eventually got dragged in. Got threatened with being charged with insubordination, and you've already been told no. And then eventually got told to fuck off again. This time to Sydney to go to dive school.
Oh, really?
And then later, speaking with some of the people that were in the divisional management then. They said the only reason we sent you there is because we knew you'd be back very quickly after failing the course. But I never went back.
Right. So you get out there. I mean, one of the things I always hear that the Army is notorious for is it's teaching you not to think for yourself. But I'm talking to a soldier or anybody, I say, tell me what your opinion of that. So what's your opinion of that?
No, it's definitely not. I was in the Navy first before I transferred across to the Army. It depends what job you're doing. I was over in special operations, and there's a huge amount of initiative that's left up to you, a huge amount of responsibility that's left up to your initiative. So. And like the rank structure is not so much as recognized. It's everybody's passed the course, everyone's done the hard work, the blood, sweat and tears have gone in, and it's sort of like this mutual respect through the ranks. And even in the unit that I was in, we didn't wear a uniform. It was a set of black overalls or green overalls or camouflage, whatever it may be.
Right.
It wasn't like this formalized, regimented idea that you have of the army. And if you remember that scene in Forrest Gump, what's your purpose in life? To do whatever it is you tell me to, drill sergeant. It's like, God damn it, Gump, that is the best answer I've ever heard.
Right.
Yeah. So it wasn't really like that. Obviously the selection processes and selection, it literally is hell on earth. They break you and then they rebuild you. And when they rebuild you, you become part of a brotherhood of the very smallest of percentiles in the population of people that make it through those programs. And in a way, and I've said it before, that they sort of are the ultimate boys clubs. You know, it's not a membership you can buy. You've got to go and get it. And very few people have had it. And I remember getting through the first selection onto dive course, the CDAC, the clearance diver acceptance test, which is our version of Hell Week. And there's very few things that will strip you as a person bare to your soul, to make you understand who you are and what you're capable of.
Yeah.
And most of the people will fail going through that process. And, you know, when we did it, it was before all the mad occupational health and safety regulations came in. So you're literally getting 1 or 2 hours sleep a night for 12 days, waking up to go and swim for 6 hours. In freezing cold water, only to find that all your wetsuits have been put in the freezer overnight and are now frozen solid. You're trying to get into a frozen wetsuit at 2 a.m.
Wow.
It's 80% mental and 20% physical. You'll be standing there. It's called speed dressing. So you'll have like three different outfits. One will be a wetsuit and fins. One will be overalls. Boots, and then one will be PT gear, runners, shorts, and a t-shirt. And I'm just you'll be lined up on the wharf on the back of a boat for hours and hours, and I'll just say dress number one, 2 minutes. And then everyone's in, and then if someone's slow, you're down doing push-ups. You might do thousands of push-ups throughout the course of the night. And they'd be like, okay, dress number three, 30 seconds. You know, just getting dressed and undressed in freezing cold water. Just the monotony of that.
Wow,
it's a head fuck, and then you've got people whispering in your ears. You know, it's just come. You can come and have a hot meal now, and a warm bed, and a zubat. And it's true. If you pull off, you can go and get all that shit. Go back and get a cold beer and a hot meal, and sleep, or you can continue on with the course. And that's I remember passing that and just going, fuck, anything's possible now.
Really?
So yeah. Sleep deprived, food deprived, cold, wet. All the things that are you would think would break you actually are making you. So once they've done that, where did they take you then? I mean, obviously you get into a unit, you're working with other team members, you know, and I don't know whether you've read any of Stephen Coulter's stuff about flow states, and he goes in and speaks with a lot of Navy SEALs about, you know, how they operate as and get into these flow states, because then, you know, they're kind of hacking consciousness and becoming one unit. So where did you end up then? What happened next?
So I deployed to, then I started dive course. That was just the beginning. Then you go into a 9-month dive course.
Right.
The maritime tactical operation phase of that, literally from Monday to Friday, you're working 100 hour week, and between 4 and 8 hours of that a day is finning underwater. So you with a LAR5, breathing pure oxygen, swimming at about 6 meters depth. And that's for doing amphibious assaults on beaches or wharfs or ships. And so you need to be able to swim 2,000 yards in an hour. And you just do that over and over again all day. So that was the only phase after the acceptance test that was what I found physically probably mentally more challenging than the acceptance test itself. But yeah, 9 months of dive course, and then I was actually posted to sea for a couple of years. So yeah, which was fun. You know, you was on a small boat, mine hunter. There's a crew of about 44 people, but you mean turning up in foreign ports with, yeah, a bunch of mates that hadn't seen land or beer for weeks and hadn't had anywhere to spend your pay packet. So yeah, all the romantic stories of the Navy that you see and hear about, they're all true. Yeah.
Yeah. So you ended up becoming a sniper, right? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I went from being at sea to one of the dive teams. I worked also at the dive school there as an assistant instructor. And then I think I was back at sea at the stage. Mm-hmm. And then obviously September 11 had happened. Australia stood up Tactical Assault Group East, which was a mixture of Army and Navy. Well, the Navy guys, we had to go over to the Army, go through their selection programs and training programs. And then, yeah, I really struggled. That was even less physical and more mental. It'd be going through, I mean, literally within a short space of time, your skill, fire, four-story house filled with smoke, no lights. You've got your gas mask on, your respirator on, you're shooting live ammunition, and if you're not the people doing the run through on the targets that you were given to shoot in the house, then you're standing on each side of the target, so you're literally shooting live ammunition.
Wow.
Within extremely close proximity to your best mate's heads, and
wow.
Yeah, that's you know, there's zero room or margin for error in that. And I really struggled with that course. It was called Close Quarter Battle. Just really struggled. And then I remember getting, we were called in on the last day. There were five of us. And most, you know, a large majority of the course has already been lost at this stage. Like, you know, failing certain tests. There were five of us called in on the last day. And basically, listen, you know, you guys are fucking struggling, and today is the last day of the course and your last opportunity to show us that you should be here. And of those five, I was the only one that made it through that day. I remember getting the letter. You know, they give you a letter, take it back to your room, you read it, tells you if you pass or failed. I was just bursting into tears, you know. Big, tough, tattooed, now special forces dude sitting there sobbing in his room, because it had been such a head fuck. And then I was on the teams at the unit, and I've been there 2 days literally, and they said, you're going to do sniper's course. It wasn't even a question. It's like, this is where you're going.
So did everybody go and do that, or were they handpicking people that they thought had a certain skill?
No, there was only two of us. Right. So we were sent over to the SAS training barracks in Perth, and put through the sniper's course over there. Before returning back, at the time, I said, what was the second commando regiment where Tactical Assault Group Beast was housed.
Right.
Then were you deployed? I know you were deployed into Iraq a few times. How long before you ended up seeing some action there?
So, I mean, our roles were with the unit that I was with, that was right. Domestic counterterrorism role. When I went to Iraq, I left the military and worked for private militaries that were subsequently employed by US-led coalition in Iraq. So, yeah, I went over, I mean, straight away from the first job that we, you know, I signed up for over there, working with, actually very interesting. It was a team of Australian lawyers and diplomats that were helping to retrain or rebuild a legal system that was going to trial Saddam Hussein. And whilst we had nothing to do with that other than providing security for the Australians that were over there, we got to sit in on some very interesting meetings. I think there was seven judges on the initial panel that was supposed to trial Saddam, and not one of them made it to the actual trial alive. They were all assassinated.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
My God. How do you get your head around it? I know. I mean, how did you get your head around it? Like, that's insane.
It's where rocks, you know, I was in the same place and war was insane. And they, you know, these are the things that happen, unfortunately.
So what happened in the end? Like, how did you, like, what made you, you know, move on from that, and where did that take you?
So I went on from doing security work, all this close protection work, into training in Iraq, training Iraqi National Police, and then training and mentoring the special police, so the paramilitary wing of the police. And this was a mixture of Sunni and Shiite recruited at mass as quickly as possible from all over the country.
Fucking disaster.
It was a fucking disaster. And, you know, so, I mean, I learned some lessons at the time, which didn't become lessons until like sometime later, when I could look back on them with a bit more, I suppose, water under the bridge. And then I eventually ended up working with a team that was deployed with the US Army Corps of Engineers, AEGIS, a program called Matrix out of Baghdad. I remember too, you know, the teams, there was all of us had come in, you know, from other organizations or whatever, and because they were expanding the project in Baghdad and other parts around the country. And you know, I remember set two, you know, security team two, which actually we do recon with the US Army Corps of Engineers, looking at major infrastructure that had been destroyed and needed to be rebuilt. So we would look at things from a security standpoint, whilst the Corps would be looking at it from a bricks and mortar standpoint.
Right.
And I just remember being in the ops room, and they're like, okay, there's two positions available on set two. And everyone knew that was the team that had the command sergeant major. And he doesn't like to fly anywhere. He wants to drive everywhere. So it's the team that would be getting a shitload of action. And like no one put their hand up. So I'm like, fuck yeah, I'll do it. And straight away, my best mate, Dino, his hand shot up, and people were like, okay, fucking sweet. But yeah, you know, it was interesting time, say living in Baghdad, to say the least. And I'd already been stationed up in northern Baghdad for quite some time, in a place that was, you know, much hotter in terms of daily attacks and that than what the green zone was. So my next project with Atrix was based out of the green zone, but previously living in Adamir, which is not far from Sada city, you know, the Shiite stronghold there. And we had a Sunni general living on our base, you know, only a few miles away. And I remember being there the day Saddam was hung, and just having rockets and mortars and everything come over, you know, because we had such a strong a Sunni presence in the training facility there. But, you know, it was the stuff that was going on around us. And I mean, the first night I got to that base, we had three rockets come through the front gate. And it's like, oh shit, you know.
Wow.
And we'd been sent in there as a replacement team, because the last team had been taken at gunpoint as part of like a hostile takeover of that project. So we were sent in there as part of CPAT, Civilian Police Assistance Training Team, working with the US Marines to try and stabilize that program and get it going again.
That's incredible. If we think about, like, we'll talk about it in a minute about what you actually do, and there's two questions here I have for you. And before I get into the two questions, did you enjoy marching powder? great book.
What,
right,
the book or the
experience
or living the real life story? I thought maybe not as well written as what it could have been, but nonetheless, the story carries it through. And it's fantasy shit. And then what do they say? Real life is crazier than fiction. You literally can't make that stuff up.
No, but does it actually? I don't know whether you've read Shantaram. Have you read Shantaram?
Yeah, I have. Hey, yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Hey.
Yeah, it was a great book. If we can just explain what you do, and then if I can ask the question, what humbled you? Something must have happened that humbled you, you know, because it seems like, you know, you were this soldier you know, on the end of a sniper rifle in fucking crazy situations. And then to go from one extreme to, I suppose it's still an extreme, but to be doing something that is so fucking noble, like something must have happened. So can you just in brief explain what you do now, what the foundation is, what it does for women, what it does for animals, and then what, if you can tell me what you feel was the moment that you were humbled to be able to give back the way you obviously do.
Okay, yeah. So after leaving Iraq, spent a year in South America. Maybe we'll get back to that after this and talk a bit more about marching powder. I sort of really, as a person, and spent a year of drugs and alcohol, and, you know, it's a big problem with a lot of ex-service members. And just, you know, from the unit I just spoke about, Tactical Assault Group Beast, had a good mate commit suicide a few days ago. So we just, you know, in the process of helping the family, you know, I mean, even during COVID and all that, helping the family get back to Australia and prepare for Maxie's funeral. I spent a lot of time lecturing in the States. 22 US veterans a day commit suicide there. It's, you know, it's a real problem. And our leaders keep sending away our children to fight their arguments, but not ready to pick up the pieces when they come home. So that's, you know, I was one of the lucky ones. The downward spiral of drugs and alcohol for me became a kick in the ass to get my shit together. And Africa was the next step, and came over to Africa and having, you know, it's not like there was a major epiphany moment. There was literally like a moment that it just became the point of no return. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in the decade before that led up to the formation of what has now become the International Anti-Poaching Foundation. So we set up in 2009, and that was after spending 6 months working in the field with rangers and seeing what it is they do. After coming from units that we had millions and millions of dollars to do what we needed, working in systems that had billions and billions of dollars to go out there and destroy countries. You know, that sort of shit plays a large role in humbling anybody, I think, if you've got the conscience to look back and reflect on it. You know, I suppose it wasn't like there was this big, huge overnight shift in me, and it's like a progress that I would say has been going on for years now. And you know, every day I'm conscious about how can I do a little bit better today than what I did yesterday in something, or you know, I'm happy to critique myself. But it's, you know, we don't have billions of years to evolve like nature's had. We've as humans, we've got a handful of decades at best. Evolution is the cutting away of the bits that don't work and retaining the bits that do. And that's essentially what it's been for me over the years. And look, you know, I'm not going to lie, there's still a little bit of ego that creeps in here and there, and to a certain point it can be healthy. There's still, you know, the alpha type thing there, and it's you know, that's there, and it's just a matter of I don't know, it's just trying to be honest. And you know, for, I mean, there was so much period as a kid, you know, from that 17, 18 year age through to sort of mid to late 20s, when it was just, you know, what can I do to impress, you know, from hunting animals to joining various units in the military to, you know, how many houses can I accumulate in residential property? For whatever reason it may be, to try and make money or have adventure. But the other half was also to try and impress people. And you sort of get to a point and realize that the only person you need to answer to is yourself. And if you can't do that, then nothing else really matters. Mm-hmm.
So what was that turning point, though? Like, I've heard you say that you witnessed an animal in pain. Can you tell us about that? And you realized that was a turning point for you?
Yeah, there was a couple of major things that happened. One, seeing a buffalo with her leg caught in a snare. This is a Cape buffalo, one of the most powerful and dangerous animals in Africa, and definitely the one that when you're on foot on patrol, you're most mindful of. Mm-hmm. They say it's the only animal that will hunt a human out of spite.
Really?
Yeah. And to see this sort of powerful, majestic animal stuck there in a snare, that in itself was tough. But when we had to euthanize it because she'd ripped her pelvis in half, she started giving birth to a stillborn calf. And that's, this sort of, I killed animals, I'd cut them open. I've had lots of blood on my hands from seeing bad things or doing bad things to animals. And that's shit that I have to live with. But I don't know what it was, that buffalo, but it was fucked up, hey? In a way, it was sort of a rebirth. So as a combination of that and seeing an elephant with the face cut off or something is the size of a truck killed for something you can hold in one hand. Yeah, you sort of get to a point where it's just, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution.
So do you feel getting in and setting this up? I mean, were you angry about it? Were you angry about what was going on and that's what was driving it? Or were you like, no, we have to fucking do something and everybody needs to be a part of it?
It wasn't anger. It was just sorrow, I think. I never had cared for animals. I think, Iraq was a way of breaking down a lot of the barriers for me, seeing a country and a people sort of flattened and oppressed like that. And knowing that you played a part in it, it's some serious reflection there, hey? Mm. And so these sort of, I call them these plates of armor of ego and machoism that I'd put around myself have been slowly getting chipped away at over the years. And I don't know if that's an experience thing or if it's a, just an evolution thing, maybe a combination of the two. But getting older and wiser and a bit more time for reflection outwards and inwards on who you are as a person and what is your purpose. Purpose is the most elusive thing in life, and a lot of us spend our lifetime looking for it. Asking myself, what is my purpose? What can I do? That sort of point I had. I had a few things. I had money. I had a certain set of skills that I thought could be useful to help in this situation, and I had time.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I think you, by the sounds of it, you were identifying with that whole masculine ego side of it, and this thing obviously humbled you enough to go, right, that's not all of who I am here, there is another side, or there's this other part of me, and I can actually do something to help. Is that, that's how it sounds to me, is that right?
Yeah, it is. And it's not like a matter of sitting down and writing out all the good things you're going to do in the future on a piece of paper. It becomes infectious. You do a little bit here and then it's like, okay, that's cool. It grows, or you get some more funding to make that bigger. And then you've got to take the next step up as a person, as an organization. And just the momentum just keeps growing and growing. It's like, I say to a lot of people, you just take the first step. Just take the first step and then just keep trying to put one foot in front of the other. And it's just that evolution thing. Just, you don't have to do it all overnight. And even when we're talking about the vegan movement and all that, I think, we can be our own worst enemies, because people will be shitting on other people for, you did this or you did that. It's not perfect. And it's like, well, okay, I fucked up, or you fucked up. Who cares? It's just sorted out tomorrow.
I think this is one of the things that when I was looking at your work, and actually one of our friends introduced us to your work, and she was talking about how you understand why people do what they do, but why the poachers were doing what they did. I see this is in, for me, I've seen over the years, you see on Facebook, you see somebody posting a picture of these guys killed this animal, and then all the comments underneath, they should be shot, they should be killed, somebody skinned them alive and stuff like that. And I'm like, that is you basically, those people who are commenting are basically demonstrating the exact traits that they're condemning in the other person. And it's like, yeah, that doesn't help. Like, I think that's just you.
Part of the problem.
It's part of the problem. And understanding both sides of the scenario, I think, make a difference. Mm. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, the responsibility of socioeconomic development, I think, unfairly falls on the shoulders of conservation as an industry so much. We're out there trying to do work in nature, but we can't do the work in nature unless the communities that live alongside us are functioning well or have support. So then this double load we have to try and deal with. And to be fair, community development, or for at least for us as an organization, but for most organizations that start out in conservation, community development is not part of the original strategy or vision or more importantly, skill set. And you know, for us, and I mean, I used to start my lectures by saying, I know what we're doing is not the right thing, but I don't know a better way. And think of what we're doing as like a paramedic, trying to get this situation to the operating table so someone with a better idea or better solution can save it. And that's when we're working in what was an increasingly militarized environment, or the militarization of the conservation industry. And that was happening or escalating just as I stepped into the industry in 2009, the beginning of the Rhino Wars. People with my skills, there was more and more opportunities. Rhino deaths are going up each year. People are combating that with military grade hardware, military techniques and tactics, bigger fences and more guns. And you know, I knew, you know, as we scaled as an organization in size and geographical footprint, and some of the more, I would say, you know, tougher assignments that we're taking on in terms of the threat level that we're facing, you know, it became more and more apparent that the kind of continent that's going to have 2 billion people by 2040, that we're not going to save nature with this militarized outlook. We need to find a way to get communities to be functioning with conservation, not separate from conservation. And while we keep drawing the divide between the two, we've got to remember that for thousands of years before we put fences around national parks and called them national parks, people lived with nature as part of nature. We didn't have cities that separated traditional migratory routes. We didn't have towns that blocked off or wanted to where animals wanted to go and drink. We didn't have villages that want to cut down a forest and establish themselves where one species may be endemic to. So accelerating over the last couple of hundred years, in particular the last 50 years, and you know, we need to find a way to create that balance and build a bridge back between conservation and communities, between nature and people.
So how do you feel do you feel you guys are getting traction there? I mean, how are the numbers? What feedback are you getting that tells you, hey, look, we're on track, we're actually getting some traction?
Yeah, so us as an organization, just to give the listeners some context, in 2015 through to about 2017, we were working on this project in Mozambique. It was increasingly militarized, and that was the turning point for us in saying, okay, we are going to find a different way to do this. Looked at a lot of different models of what was happening, looked at other industries, and then looked again internally at conservation and us as an organization. And there are a number of factors that eventually led us to trial what has become or scaled to become the only network of nature reserves in the world to be protected by women, or all female armed anti-poaching units. There's a whole list of reasons, but that's where we've come to now, and I'm extremely happy about the progress and about where we're going. The results speak for themselves in terms of, in the initial area where we started, we had an 80% downturn in elephant poaching across the region. This is a region that had lost 8,000 elephants in the 16 years prior to the establishment of this program. And so we played a large role through our on-the-ground work and through our investigations work and community development in helping to really drive that number down. the areas that we take over, or I said take over, we establish long-term leases with rural district councils and local traditional leaders and community. They're all former trophy hunting areas. So these are areas that are being lost to human settlement and agriculture as the trophy hunting industry declines. And around across Africa, around 3% of the entire surface area of the continent is set aside as areas under communal land trust. And the economic model that has been used many decades has been commercial trophy hunting. So what we've, rather than look at hunting as an argument to be had, we looked at it as an equation to be solved. And for the listeners out there, trophy hunting is different to poaching. Trophy hunting is legal in many countries, mm-hmm. whereas poaching is the illegal exploitation of natural resources, whether that be killing elephants for their tusks or buck or plains game for their for the meat, other animals, pythons, for example, for their skin, whatever it may be. That is the illegal version. The legal version is the hunter coming over from America, so to say, so he can go out and shoot an elephant, stuff it and stick it on his wall. The first area where we started with, remember, we started with 16 women in general as a program. We now have 240 staff spanning an area of about 400 kilometres from east to west. The first areas had a wild, increase in wildlife numbers around 399% now.
Wow.
That was only after 3 years. There's all these other metrics and things that we're learning along the way. The empowerment of women in these programs, something we didn't expect, led to a 60% downturn in serious sexual assault rape cases.
Wow.
Some of the things that we've seen in what we do, the economic side, which is linked to the lack of corruption that we've seen with women, the economic benefits of this program, where we had historically recruited males from hundreds of kilometres away to come in and protect these areas to avoid collusion with communities they'd grown up with. As we've scaled, we haven't had to employ from miles away because we haven't seen corruption with the women. So it means we can employ directly from the community alongside the area we're trying to protect. And it turns the largest line item in our budgets, which is ranger salaries, into a direct community investment. On paper, we're putting the same amount into these communities every 34 days as what trophy hunting was doing per annum prior to its demise.
Wow.
And then the bottom line then triples because women are spending 80 to 90% of their salary on versus a male that's spending 30 to 40%.
Sorry, just say that again. Women were spending 80 to 90% of their salary on
just spending
in the local community versus a male that spends around 30 to 40% of their salary locally. So
this is mother nature though. Hey, it's not father nature. This is the feminine energy is definitely the more dominant energy.
So I'd like to ask a little bit more about that and about that whole, because that is empowering, I think, for a lot of people to hear, for a lot of women to hear. But what led to that in terms of and I don't know, just talk to me about the
clicked?
Female.
What clicked? Where did you go, oh shit, look at this.
Let me just have a wipe down here. Sweating up.
You look gorgeous. Degrees. Don't worry, Dan, you look lovely.
I'm dripping. So we looked at other industries that were getting ahead by getting more women on the boards, more women as CEOs, more women in management, versus the conservation industry, where women were outnumbered by men in frontline roles by around 100 to 1. So lacking the exposure to the experience they needed to rise up in the management positions. Meant that we would stagnate as an industry if we didn't create that exposure.
Right.
We saw a lot of women in conservation with other organisations that were essentially put a uniform on and a weapon in their hands. They get the photos taken for fundraising or whatever it may be, this form of tokenism, and certain projects in particular where we knew men were actually doing the hard yards and women were in the window front, so to speak. And so I sort of undermined the women because they weren't given the opportunity to do the full job, and it undermined the men because they were actually out there doing the hard yards but not getting the credit for it. Right. So for us, it was just a question of, you know, can these women do selection? And, you know, we still weren't convinced. I was having a very tough time at board level in freeing up. It seemed a bit gimmicky and risky for an organisation that had sort of beaten a fairly large drum from the military front of how we go about doing our job. And, you know, for us to sort of what would maybe perceived as a softening of our image, it was a risk. And I'll say that. Then I read an article. I was actually in New York at the time. Read an article online in the New York Times about the US Army Rangers putting women through their training and preparation for frontline deployment. And so this was a decade earlier in Baghdad when we're on a mission heading up to towards Camp Anaconda in northern Baghdad, and one of our convoys had been hit coming through a checkpoint. There's a few people there killed at the checkoint. And we were surrounded, like sort of Mahdi army militia. I had a Dushka anti-aircraft gun held to my head. So I was like, fuck, this is it. And it was the US Army Rangers that came in and got us out of there alive.
Really?
And so, reading that article a decade later, I'm like, okay, if these guys can train women for deployment to do the same shit that saved my life 10 years ago, then we can do the same with women here as wildlife rangers. That's when it started, essentially.
Love that.
A number of years ago, I've spent quite a bit of time in India, and a number of years ago, I ended up at a fundraiser with a woman from Karen up in Perth, and she was rescuing the sun bears. And she had basically been in China and lifted up this basket, and the sun bear was there, and she wanted to find out what was happening, and then realized
the
dancing bears, and they take them away, they pull their nails out, they pull their teeth out, and then they put them on a chain, and as tourists go past, they make them dance. And I've seen that a few times in India, even up until today. But she was doing a fundraiser, and then we got an invite out to where the actual compound was that she had set up. So when we went out there, it was a really interesting story. But I'm just, based on what you're saying to me, I'm starting to get my head around what had happened, because I was so taken back by when I went out there. Because when I went out there, the first thing that I noticed is that it was in the arsehole of nowhere. Like, it was literally in the middle of nowhere in India. And India's India can be a dangerous place as much as anywhere can. And when we got there, there was armed guards all around the compound. And I was like, "Is there armed guards around the compound?" They were brought inside, and when we get in through the gate, we're met. It was it felt like a bit of a setup. And it's no disrespect to this woman. She's obviously trying to do the right thing. And we were taken by four vets, and we were walked through the garden. As we walked through the garden, like, over here on the right, there was a bear that was still chained up, and he was dancing from side to side, and, you know, that's all he did all day. And then they brought us around to where the clinic was, and there was a bear in a cage, and he was running up and bashing his head off the cage. And so I was like, Jesus, this, I was really unsettled. I was like, there's something not right here. And I remember saying to them, you know, what's with the bear over here? And they say, when they're taking off their owner, they go a bit crazy. And I said, what about the bear in the cage? And they said, he's just suffering because he misses his owner. And then, you know, we were brought in, shown around some stuff, and then we were taken back out and we left. Now, but when we were there, I was like, how many bears you got in here? And they're like, oh, we have 44 bears in here. So I didn't see 44 bears, and I don't know where they were keeping them in the compound. And so when I got out, I was like, but, you know, I was, you know, how are you doing this? And they said, well, we go down to them and we take the bear off them. And then what we do is we give them some money and they'll go and buy a rickshaw. And then they have, rather than earning money from making the bear stance, they're able to, you know, earn money from the rickshaws. But it turned out that we kept in contact, and within a month, there was only two bears left. And then I was like, so why did you have armed guards on the place? They said, because the locals come over and they can't understand why we will feed a bear, but we won't feed a human. And they'll chuck meat over the wall, and they were poisoning the bear. So they were shooting them.
Jeez.
shooting at the people and you know, to keep them away. And then, so 42 of the bears had died. And we were like, so, you know, talking to the guys, you know, what did they do? He said, most of them died of heartache because they missed their owner, you know? So, but I can see, like, the thing is I can see what she was trying to do, and you have to start somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You may not get it right at the beginning, but the point is that we can't ignore it either, you know? And these people, you know, these bears, their owners are their master. They love them, you know? And you take an owner away from its master, it breaks the bear's heart.
Yeah.
So did you guys go through any of that sort of stuff? I mean, how do you negotiate? People who are making money to feed their families by selling ivory or tusk, or how do you handle that? Is that part of the conservation?
Yeah, you know, this is, I mean, I'll tell you, the toughest part of our job is having to arrest someone and put them in prison. I mean, sometimes it's, you know, quite often it's someone involved with organized crime, and you know, that's actually a pleasure. But you know, the poor villager that is, you know, trying to make some bucks here or there, there's nothing fun about that, I promise you. There's nothing glamorous. There's no smiles. But I don't know if this is a way of me reasoning or justifying in my own mind, but I look at where we are as a global community. I look at, we're with 8 billion people on the planet, at a time when civilization has been brought to its knees by a small scaly anteater called a pangolin and some bats. And that is our pressure on biodiversity and on nature, and our future as a civilization is dependent on our willingness to preserve biodiversity. And at some point we need to draw a line in the sand and say we have to hold on to what we have left, because if we don't, there's too much at stake. And so these are the tough jobs that we have to do on behalf, the tough jobs and tough decisions we have to do on behalf of an international community. And you know, look at the thankless, often thankless job of a ranger, to be thankless, such as this woman who's protecting bears, thankless in the eyes of the locals. A ranger often ridiculed, even assaulted by certain groups of people. But when we're looking at whether it's traveling to Africa, whether it's watching it on television, reading about it in magazines, whether it's the importance that biodiversity brings, that all comes down at the end of the line to one group of people, and it is the group of people that protect those areas. And without them out there now doing that $1,400 a month, risking their life every day, spending 11 months of the year away from their families, we wouldn't have any of that nature. And so when we sit on the other side of the world and be grateful for the air that we breathe and the nature that we can visit or switch the telly on and watch, we really need to acknowledge the work that rangers do. And who knows what pandemics rangers may have stopped in the past or will stop in the future just by protecting these animals from reaching wet markets in the first place. And I fully acknowledge there's a huge machine that operates below the rangers and keeping them out there deployed on the front line and fed and clothed and equipped and led, and the fundraising that goes into it and the reporting and the events and the graphic design for the posters and the legal stuff and the contracts, the government negotiations, the land negotiations, the community work. But we need to give more credit to these people. I mean, we sit there, sit back and hail and worship people that can smack a tennis ball around better than others, or kick a football around. Yeah, they just got good at kicking footballs. They're not out risking their lives or anything for a bigger cause. Yeah, we like to have a beer and watch the sports on TV, but I think we really need to shift what our idea of a hero is in society. It's the people that are out there doing shit like what the rangers are doing. Yeah, I'm not someone that makes fucking $15 million a game playing football.
I was just going to say, I mean, obviously a big part of the fucking problem is consumerism, you know, super high net worth individuals thinking it's an honor to be given, you know, or to give a piece of ivory as a gift. Like it's so fucking ridiculous. Like it's just, if they just understood that it's not an honor. In actual fact, it's completely the opposite. So is there any way in which you guys are are trying to go at that end of the problem?
Well, that's the education side. Like, even as I hear you talking about the Dancing Bears and what you were talking about there, Damien, to me it seems like that's where education needs to come in. And with this, that's is that a part of what you do, you know, and how you help and give it's back?
Locally, but we, well, in Asia, for example, not to highlight part of the problem by saying that, specifying that, but there's organisations that operate and they're specialised in advertising and demand reduction is what we are in on-the-ground solutions. But, I mean, like, we can't, I find it difficult to get up on the soapbox and point the finger and talk about someone's cultural history or traditional medicine uses. When we as a society, when I say a society, the West really has so much to answer for. And if we want to talk about, the receipt of these goods, or receiving these goods or wanting these goods, it's no different to someone wanting a Rolex or someone wanting a Ferrari or someone wanting a bigger house or a fancier suit or a flash, you know, a flashier car, whatever it may be. And a lot of that, it comes back to ego. It's like, look at me, look who I am, look what I have, look what I can afford. And I suppose, the constant battle for so many people is with ego. And when you realize that it's actually not cool, it doesn't look cool, and you don't have to buy all that shit, you don't need to live in a big house, you don't need to spend so much money trying to keep up with other people that are in your network so that you don't feel like you're getting left behind. Like, the freedom that comes with being able to let go of that mindset and understand that you can live in a reasonably small size house. You don't need, you know, all this other flashy shit around you and all the fancy stuff. It's very liberating.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when I was listening to one of the interviews that I really got is that you know, we have this idea of what a man is. Do you know what I mean? A man is strong and all this. But in actual fact, it felt like from the interview, like it was really lovely and it was really humbling to hear you talk about, look, this is what I did, this is who I was. But what a real man is someone that realizes that that's not all that you are. And, you have taken off a lot of the armor. You have put down, you know, you have looked at who you were. You have taken where you've come from and turned it into something quite extraordinary. And so you have the blokey bloke out there who thinks, you know, there's so much who thinks that they've got to be big and strong and shoot and kill and, you know, and do extreme shit. What's your message to those guys to help them to realize that that's actually not what the fuck it's all about?
It's not, you know, the more people that want to live like that, the shittier the place is going to be. The more people that are going to suffer, the more people are going to be hurt. And really it is, it's just a little three-letter word called ego. I still get shit from mates and other people about the vegan side and fucking tofu boy and all. It's like, whatever, man. One, I am an alpha male because it's just who I am and I can't change that. Two, I don't want to fuck with something that can't defend itself. Okay, I've done that before and I won't do it again. And three, I don't want to pay someone else to do my dirty work. And when I talk about this, I'm talking about what we do to animals here. You know, it's not cool. And, you know, we do things to animals that would be classified as torture or murder if we did them to people, but we were able to separate what's convenient for us and what we like from what we don't want to acknowledge. For me, it all just came down to the genuine understanding and realization that I don't want to be a part of that system anymore. I work in conservation. It's the protection of the environment, the protection of animals. The media industry is the greatest negative environmental impact we have on this planet and responsible for the death of over 100 billion animals a year. Who the fuck wants to be part of that? It's one of the main drivers of climate change. It's part of the reason we're on our knees right now with COVID-19. And we can't fly around the world and see our families. We're going to look at trillions of dollars in international economic deficit. Just because we're digging our appetites and we're taking so much along for the ride with us. That's not right. It's just we don't need meat. We just like the taste of it.
I think we attach so much to these ideals of who we're supposed to be, you know, and who, what a man is. And I think we think that strength just looks like that machoism, but strength is also the ability to soften and be sensitive and understand that other creatures have just as much to offer. You know, I was hearing you say about the difference in one of the, I don't know what animal you were talking about, but you were saying that they could tell the difference between the two different tribes. One tribe had tried to harm them and another hadn't, and they could hear it in their voices or something like that. And I feel like, you know, we think that we're all that just because we have this way of communicating, but just because another species doesn't know how to communicate in the same way, it doesn't mean that they don't understand and they're not sentient beings and they don't have an understanding or a consciousness, you know?
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, animals are so much more complex than we can ever comprehend in so many ways. In so many ways, we're blind and deaf to what is going on in their world. But the language of suffering is universal.
Yes.
And I suppose that's the key point for me. The only difference between the capacity and the capacity of a rhino to suffer from a cow is the difference we allow ourselves to accept in our own minds, and that comes down to conscience. And what level of our conscience are we willing to acknowledge? And if it's part or none, or 99%, then really, is that the person you want to be? When you allow it to be 100%, and you can make decisions based on what you genuinely believe to be right and wrong, it's a big step, eh? It's not an easy step.
No.
It's a much fucking tougher step than going down the gym and putting on 20 kilos of muscle and learning how to shoot a gun and getting into a bar fight. That shit's fucking easy. 100% of your conscience.
You know, I could talk for another hour, but we do probably have to wrap it up. But before we do, how would you recommend people can help or support, or what are the tips that you would give to people to be able to contribute in some way, or even in their own lives take responsibility in some way?
Yeah, I think definitely from a nature perspective is to research what's going on, be more informed, be more educated. When you're better educated, you're better armed to make the right decisions. And often, you know, for a lot of the big changes that I've been able to make individually or as part of the organization has been based on research or inspiration from other people that are involved in our movement or range of movements that we're working in, whether it be conservation, environment, climate change, the animal rights side. And then find organisations to support or how you can support them. It doesn't necessarily have to be us. Or those that want to know more about us, the International Anti-Poaching Foundation, IAPF.org. There's a bunch of information on not only on our website, but on the internet. There's a great documentary that was recently produced by James Cameron in conjunction with National Geographic about the women of Akashinga. That is available on our website. It's only a short form documentary. There will be a long form. Have a look at that. But also in our own lives, you know, how we can small changes in our lives equate to big changes in others. And if we, I think the biggest mistake we can make is to think that the accumulated effort of a lot of people is not going to add up to something. It's the biggest danger.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And we have to start taking responsibility about the actions that we have on a day-to-day basis, and building up some good credits over here doesn't give us fucking bad credits to go and do bad shit over there. For example, working in anti-poaching in Zimbabwe doesn't mean you can go home to Australia and you know, sit there and feel it's okay to eat a big steak because you're protecting all these animals over here and you've sort of built up the right to eat these other ones over there. And that's the mindset I operated with for several years. I think that any of us can make is our diets and what we put on our dinner tables, breakfast, lunch and dinner, and just, you know, looking at where our food comes from, the suffering, the pain, the environmental destruction. And I mean, really that we actually do more by doing less. If we just cut some things out of our life, we're doing far less, but achieving much more. And that's the crazy thing about all this. It's not, a lot of us just have to do less of what we're already doing to make the world a much better place.
Mm. I really like that.
You know, I'd like to think that we're on our way there. And what I want to say is that it's been lovely talking to you today and very humbling. And I think that what you've achieved and what you've done so far is absolutely fantastic. And it's been an absolute pleasure to sit here and have this conversation with you. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate your time and the time of the listeners. And I look forward to doing an update at some point in the future.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
We didn't even get to the marching powder conversation. That's a whole other story.
Actually, I had an anti-poaching story I wanted to ask him about as well. I had a mate years ago, when I was, this is very quick, I won't keep you on, but I had a mate years ago, I was up in the far north Queensland, and his name was John Gurnia, and he'd grown up in Queensland. And he'd studied environmental science with a buddy of mine, and then at 22 headed over to Africa and became an anti-poacher. And he told me the stories. He said, we were armed. He said, we'd head out into the bush. And he said, we would capture a poacher. And then he said, we'd bring him back. And he said, we'd chain him up. And then we'd, from behind him, we'd cattle prod the chains. And he said, they would think that they were, you know, it was the gods, paying out on them so that they could then question them and find out, okay, where's the rest of the poachers? And this was what they were doing. I mean, obviously that's 20, 25 years ago that they were doing that sort of stuff. Yeah. But it's obviously evolved since then about how they find that sort of information out. But he was like, some of the stories he was telling me, I was like, holy shit. And he was 22 when that stuff was going on. He said he had a mate of his had a lion as a pet. And, you know, the lion would walk around the house. He said, a fucking full fucking lion would walk around the house in a compound in a cage. And that was his pet, you know, and he hung out with this guy and drank beers with him and they'd get drunk and the fucking lion would be there. And the only reason the lion was there was because they were feeding the fucking thing, you know, and it wasn't hungry. It wouldn't eat them. But crazy, crazy. That was the first time I heard about any of this anti-poaching stuff was when I was 22.
Mm. Oh, it's evolved since then. Hopefully. Hopefully. Yeah. I think Damien has cut out there, but
again,
it was
great
having you on
there,
Damien. Hopefully you can hear this.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.